This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
You're tuned in to the Evening Edition, and I'm Ezra Zayed. On the show today, we'll be talking about sex education. And before we go any further, it's a conversation that for most is difficult to have. For all intents and purposes, you, the listener, might not be comfortable with it. But if it helps, you might not be the only one. It's a conversation that many are reluctant to have, be it schools, parents, ministries, and governments. And this is a real global challenge.
The ongoing debate over Ontario's sex ed curriculum heated up again
today. By all accounts, Germany is one of the most progressive countries when it comes to sexual education.
Namaste and greetings from the World Health Organization. In my presentation today, I want to make the case to you that we need to accept that we are, in fact, shying away from sexuality education.
So let's look at the broader issue. Should we teach children about sex and relationships earlier than we currently do? To discuss this, we're joined by...
And while the rest of the world is figuring out the best type of sex education for their communities, back here in Malaysia, we haven't even landed on whether we should have sex education. A conversation that's been delayed far too long, especially with the rising social problems and issues that we face in our society.
In Malaysia, there have been a number of high-profile cases of baby dumping. According to government figures, there have been more than 500 such cases recorded since 2005.
Dato' Sri Najib Tun Razak mahu pelajar Tajaan Majlis Amanah Rakyat Mara Nur Fitri Azmir Nurdin yang dipenjara kerana kesalahan memiliki pelbagai bahan ucah melampau membabitkan kanak-kanak menjalani...
Isteri lalu pesalah pedofilia Richard Huckle dijatuhi hukuman penjara seumur hidup selepas didapati bersalah terhadap 71 pertuduhan penderaan seksual kanak-kanak Malaysia. Huckle, 30 tahun, mengaku mendera kesemua mangsa berusia antara 6 bulan hingga 12 tahun serta memuat naik rakaman video...
All right, let's recap. Sexual abuse cases, pedophilia, baby dumping, these are words that are no longer spoken about in hushed tones. It's part of our daily concerns for our friends, families, and loved ones. And while these problems get plenty of airtime, the solutions barely see the light of day, and we'll only agree to these solutions once we actually start talking about it. And that's what we'll try and attempt this evening.
Yo, I don't think we should talk about this.
Come on, why not?
People might misunderstand what we're trying to say, you know?
No, but that's a part of life.
Nobody has quite said it better than when I first heard this in 1990, but maybe we need a reminder from Salt and Pepper.
Come on. Let's talk about sex, baby. Let's talk about...
In this hour, we'll be talking about sex education, and what that looks like in Malaysia right now. This is a tough show to do because sex education is practically absent in the country. Sure, you might say that you learned some things from your biology class in secondary school, Sekolah Menengah. You joke about it with your friends, you might embarrassingly ask your doctor if you can muster up the courage, and there are those premarital courses and cursus kawin sessions, which, by all accounts, comes too little, too late. But of course, there's the internet, and that's when I came across this show.
Apa sebenarnya itu sex? Sebenarnya, bila kita gunakan perkataan sex, ada banyak definisi yang berlainan.
That's June Lau, the host of an online video series called Pope Pope.
The show allows people privacy. They can watch it when they want, kids especially, on their phones or whatever. And that enabled me to also get a wider audience to teach. And I think it's really important. Also, no one else is doing it.
There just aren't many sex educators around, if at all. We got her in the studio to have a candid conversation about what's happening and what's lacking when dealing with sex education. Here's our conversation. I'm trying to figure out about how Malaysians learn about sex. And A, for myself, I learned it from friends, some old VHSs. And at some point in, might have been form two, form three, I remember my teacher trying to explain the anatomy of the human body. And you learn that through biology about what happens in the reproductive process of sex. But pretty much after that moment, it's a free-for-all as to how kids learn about sex. And you learn all the good things and all the bad things. Is that my only experience, or is that a pretty common experience for most Malaysians?
It's pretty common. I think back then it was the odd VHS. But right now, I mean, lots of stuff has come to light on how there's lots of content, lots of pornography available on Telegram messaging apps and stuff like that. So it is a free-for-all. It's easy access, pornography, easy access. Whether you look for it or not, it's popping up on your browser. So it's different times we're living in, and access to pornography is ever-present. Kids are learning from that, which is very dangerous.
But in terms of a structured approach as to how schools are educating sex, what's the landscape look like?
From what I can see, largely what's on offer is abstinence-only education. And the act of sex is generally viewed as defiant behavior or saved for marriage. So when you have kids, immediately the go-to is, let's tell them don't do it because we'll ruin their innocence. And schools don't want to have to deal with parents yelling at them for teaching sex, right? This is an international problem. So the easiest is to go, okay, we tell kids just don't do it and you'll be all right. It's easy. Then they don't have to teach the awkward stuff. And actually, maybe it's a capacity issue also, because there's no one to teach it. No one is comfortable talking about condoms and things like that. And we've seen heads of departments saying, we won't have a condom demonstration because we are not encouraging children to have sex. It's quite misinformed. These programs are brought in either by ministries such as LPPKN, which are still pushing their Moju Chakna Diri, the ones that have been in the papers lately, pro-abstinence. And people like Focus on the Family, who run an abstinence-only Christian-backed kind of syllabus. These programs, to me, are very dangerous because abstinence-only means they're promoting no sexual activity before marriage. And if you look on their website, you don't have to take my word for it. It's actually all there. Safe sex is a myth. Condoms don't work. And all of this while we have a society which is plagued by teenage pregnancies and babies being dumped, and we're trying to prevent all of that. And the only way is through safe sex. So how can you promote this message that safe sex doesn't work? And it's one of many problems with the syllabus that's being taught. If you ask me, where are kids learning about sex? I think that's not so much the issue. It's what are they learning when sex ed is given to them by people they're supposed to trust? It's like their schools, their teachers.
To some degree, we have sex ed, but abstinence-based programs are happening in schools. The counter to that would be what?
Comprehensive sex education.
And what does that entail?
Comprehensive sex education is a more, I hate this word, but holistic syllabus. It presents medically accurate information over a very broad range of subjects, including abstinence. So instead of just telling children the benefits of abstinence, we don't spread misinformation. So we say, okay, here's how your body's developing. Here are some communication skills to learn. Here's how to use a condom. Here are other forms of contraception. Here's practical information on how to navigate sex and your sexual life. But at the same time, perhaps I could give you an example. The 2015 Ontario curriculum on sex education is excellent.
And this is in Canada?
In Canada, yeah. I use it myself. So between the ages of 6 and 13... they're given age-appropriate sex education during health classes. And you look at kids age 6 being taught the correct name for genitalia, and then they move to talking to them about gender expression, safety online, contraception, body changes, a whole host of subjects. Yeah. So I always say sex education is life education and encompasses a lot of things. And these are conversations that need to take place with young people. And whenever we think, oh, we're teaching them too young, they always forget that we're talking about age-appropriate sex education. So even though I'm saying comprehensive sex education is better, I'm not saying we throw it all at them at the same time. In an ideal world, they should be taught through the ages, just like you would raise your child.
My guest is June Lau. She's a sex educator, and we'll hear more from her, especially about her experiences in teaching both kids and parents about sex education. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Bombing frustrated minds, BFM 89.9.
What's the difference between a boy and a girl?
I know a way, but I think it's really disturbing.
What is disturbing?
You know how you tell a boy pup from a girl pup? You know when people hit their thing in between their legs, you know how they say, "Oh, my nuts! Oh, my nuts!" They actually mean the, well...
Who said this?
I'm just trying to express what the question you
asked. Oh, okay. No, you go ahead. So again, though, what's the difference between a boy and a girl?
Well, I shouldn't...
And that was a segment of a young kid trying to explain to late-night host Jimmy Kimmel the difference between a boy and a girl. Now, understanding but also articulating these basic concepts is central to our topic this evening, sex education. You're tuned in to The Evening Edition, and I'm Ezra Zayed.
Hi, I'm June Lau, and I'm a sex educator in Malaysia.
She was also the host of an online show. You can find it on YouTube. It's called Pope Pope, arguably Malaysia's first sex education show.
Rancangan Pendidikan Seksual Pope Pope kembali lagi dengan musim terbaru. Soalan-soalan hangat.
And before the break, June and I were talking about the differences between two key ways sex ed is being taught. There's abstinence only, and then there's comprehensive sex education. We briefly addressed age-appropriate sex education earlier, and it's a theme that we'll be returning to. But before that, I asked June how she became a sex educator.
I was newly out of the law. I quit my law job.
You were out of the law.
I'm an outlaw. Sorry, start again. No, I just quit my law job and I was writing lots of articles and I had a bit of time on my hands. So I started experimenting with public health services, as you do when you're a big nerd. So I went and said, oh, I want to do this blood test, I want to do that. And I found that they had no problems running those tests, but they had major problems, even giving me results on STI examinations and things like that, right, pap smear. But they had major problems giving me contraception. Because I was unmarried and they wanted to know what religion I belonged to. And I said, these things shouldn't matter, right? And so I did a bit of digging and I found that there are actually lots of flaws. So I wrote some articles on that. And then somebody said, would you like to do some workshops on comprehensive sex education? And actually, I was very lucky because I got an opportunity to work with Kampung kids. So I worked with Kampung kids out on oil palm plantations for a few years. So I got a really... I got really good insight into what's going on in rural areas. Then I began doing workshops in urban areas. And I realized that actually the problem is the same. Nobody actually knows anything. It's just what is different is the approach that you must take to them. A lot of our more liberal, progressive BFM listeners are all like, hey, you should be more upfront about this. You know, you should be liberal and you can inspire them to be more progressive also. And I say, do you understand what it is? Like when you talk to an old person about a new piece of technology and they shut down. Even later on, when you talk about something they do understand, they've shut down.
This is a huge obstacle, especially when you're talking about sex.
Sex. Yeah. So when I talk to kids in rural areas, I have to be very careful because I want them to listen to the rest of the stuff I want to say. So you have to be ginger with them. If you really want to teach them, it's not about your ego. It's about what they're used to. Imagine they're in a capsule. Right. So their superstitions, their religious beliefs, it runs deep. You can't ignore it.
And when it came to, I guess, doing these workshops and speaking to parents and kids in rural urban areas, how did that actually happen? So would you get a request from a Ketua Penghulu? How does it work?
No, the rural areas, it was a Kem Cuti Sekolah kind of thing run by Saim Darby's CSR. So they organized all of it and all the kids were employees' kids. So you would have like 60 kids each time.
How old are we talking about?
13 to 17 high school kids. Very cool because some of them, like, because they're in zones, right? They've split the peninsula up into zones of plantations. So like sometimes you'd have an overlap of a zone because there's too many kids. And some kids would be back in the workshop the next time. I'm like, what are you doing here? It's the same workshop. I haven't finished asking my questions.
Wow.
Yeah, because they're desperate. They have no out, no one to ask, no internet.
Talk to me about, I guess, the vibe of just before you start talking, like just what's the vibe in the room of 60 or so kids who
they're teenagers at the end
of
it.
In the rural areas or the urban
areas? In the rural areas.
It's amazing because, like, the further up north you go, the quieter they are. They think they're in trouble.
And they know that they're in the class for sex ed.
Yeah. Then the first question I always ask is, Tauta, why we are here? Do you know why we're here? And I'm like, and you know, some of them know more than others because you have 17-year-olds in there as well. And you know, I'd hate to bring up a dodgy point at this moment, but the experience might not have been entirely consensual either.
Right.
So the choice of language is very important because if you talk about STIs by inducing fear, you stop them from ever getting help. You don't know if some of them are being sexually assaulted regularly. You know, we hear of many cases of incest and awful things happening on rural plantations. So the vibe is both a very curious vibe, but also very fearful.
Are there kids who just don't want to be there?
No, never. Never. Like, they get past the whole, like, oh, why do I have to do this? It's school holidays, you know. And the moment you open, you say what I'm going to teach you, I always tell them, very clearly, this is what I'm going to teach you. And I promise you one thing, that I'm going to answer all your questions. You can ask me any question you want, and I will answer it. At no point will I say it's a stupid question. And they love it. It builds trust, and they never want to leave. And kids are coming to me during the break to ask questions as well.
Because they've never heard that even in school, right?
No,
that there's no stupid question.
Yeah.
At which point through the workshop that you know that you've gotten their trust and interest? Because there must be a tipping point where the hands are being raised all the time.
I do that anonymous question box thing where the box goes around and the kids put questions in. So after the first round of answering questions, there'll be more questions in the box the next round. So you already know. They're testing you at first. They're asking very elementary questions. The point that you know for sure that you've made a difference in their lives is when you've got kids who are very, very quiet and conservative, very reserved in the beginning. At the end, I get them to do a little skit. Here's the problem. Act out how you would deal with this problem. And they're on stage and they're full of confidence. You've got like really conservative kids on stage saying, I say no to sexual assault. I say yes to condoms.
Wow.
Yeah. Like, how does that not keep you going, right? So for me, what I do, I love, because I see these kids actually believing in themselves a bit more and believing that they have a choice, especially when you teach the girls. Very patriarchal society, right? They don't even know that they have a choice. Most of these kids, like, they will write scenarios for that skit part of the workshop, and they'll say, like, oh, dia tak nak pakai condom. Jadi, apa nak buat? Saya dah tanya dah.
And what's your response to that as somebody who is evaluating that skill?
So you ask them, you can never go, hey, bodoh. You can never say that because that's not bodoh. That's what they've been taught. So you ask them, but you know what's the consequence if you don't use a condom. You remember? And then they'll say, oh, yeah, I could get pregnant. Oh, yeah, he could have a disease. But what if he says that he's never had sex with anybody before? Like, do you know for sure? Can you really be sure? Oh, yeah. So what should I do? Should I do it? And then you're like, it's up to you. Would you do it? Is it enough of a risk for you to take? It's like, no, maybe I just don't do it. And kids reach these conclusions by themselves.
And so I guess the whole class is observing this exchange. It's a critical thinking process that they're going through. How do they feel at the end of the 2 days?
Well, I've got like really positive feedback from them. We get them to fill in a feedback form. I've got a 93% comprehension rate. Yeah, so we assess.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. Because it's a corporate, right? So they have to do all these exercises to assess how effective the workshop is. And the thing with me is that I don't throw fancy jargon at them. I speak Malay and I speak Kampung Malay to them.
You speak Malay very well.
Thank you. So it's important to reach the kids. You have to know the lingo, you know, you have to know the slang. So I think that's why they understand. It's possible to teach sex ed without being all poncy.
So what is the approach that you use with the rural kids so that it makes it a little bit more relatable? Is it just the language? Is it the way? Is it the reference point?
It is the language. You know, when we first started doing the workshops, the organizers were actually like, you guys look too urban. Like, what do you mean I look too urban? This is what I look like.
It's your short hair,
yeah,
you know, and fancy jewelry. Yeah.
But you are a statement that it's okay to be different. So your presence is also a lesson. So I think it's just the way you present yourself, the way you talk to people. I'm very open to their questions, and I tell them that I want to hear your questions, and I talk to them and I ask them questions. We do lots of activities where we get close to each other. We build trust. I spend a long time building trust before I teach anything, you know, which is why I need a lot of time if I want to do it right. You know, if it's a class in school, for example, I like those too because I get them an hour a week, right? And over the course of a semester, we build trust. And kids choose who they want to trust. I don't know. Maybe I'm doing something right, but it's good.
Just from these questions, can you see that there's some basic preliminary knowledge, or is there actually a lot of knowledge, but they're just not voicing out? Like, what's the temperature of those questions?
From the questions, you can tell what kind of social problems exist in that zone very clearly. Like, oh, if at night someone touches you, is that okay? If, like, someone puts things inside you, but you don't really want to, can you say no? These kinds of questions, it's no joke.
And would you say these types of questions, the two that you've just mentioned, that going from state to state, is it a familiar theme?
Sometimes. I would say some of the more extreme questions I've seen involve sexual assault, involve rape. They don't even know it's rape. The way they're asking the question, they don't even know it's rape.
You know it's rape.
I know it's rape.
But the way they framed it, because there's just no context to their experience.
They're not even sure what happened to them, you know. I've had kids ask me questions like, if a man who's 40 years old is waiting outside my school for me every day, does that really mean he loves me? I've had questions like that from urban kids. So can you imagine in a plantation 50 kilometers from the nearest town? These kids don't stand a chance. So definitely from the tone of the questions, you get an idea of the social problems you're dealing with. It's always based on real life. And it's always like, oh, members are you? But as you answer questions, you may get the same handwriting asking a follow-up question. So we have to be very, very vigilant in spotting patterns and things like that. Yeah.
After the news, we continue our conversation about sex education in Malaysia with my guest, Jun Lau. Stay tuned to the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Banish fraudulent manoeuvres, BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the Evening Edition, and if you've just joined us, we're talking about sex education in Malaysia. My guest is Jun Lau. She's a sex educator, and before the break, we heard about her experiences conducting sex ed workshops specifically for children in the rural parts of the country. And a key part of how June is able to communicate effectively to these kids, especially on these issues, you know, there are a few things to keep in mind. It requires a great deal of attention. It involves providing age-appropriate knowledge. You need to build trust, but also an awareness of what ideas and perceptions these kids already have. We continue with her experiences of conducting sex education workshops, but this time for city folks in urban areas.
I think they're more expressive, urban kids. They do ask more questions, but they're just as clueless, like I mentioned earlier. The questions that I get asked, you have to gauge how much they know. And I do that through a variety of methods. Like sometimes I'll say something that invites a response. Like, oh, well, you know, we all know about those pop-ups that you accidentally click. And all the kids in the room are like, no, I never click on that. But you know, right? So boys especially, when you ask me about urban kids, right? Like, what do I see in urban kids? Unfortunately, especially KL urban, when I run a KL pack workshop, for example, I see a lot of neglected kids. I see a lot of kids that are dying for attention.
Neglected in what way?
They may have all the money in the world, you know, especially like when you talk about international school kids and everything, right? They have all the money in the world, no attention, no love. Or maybe the parents think that they're showing love by buying things or taking them places. But the kids just want somebody to talk to. And, you know, we're talking about really privileged children. And urban is not just privileged, right? But amongst the privileged, these kids are just, it's sad. They just want someone to ask a simple question like, is it okay if I use this pad?
Just basic health questions more than anything else. Yeah. Apart from speaking to kids, teenagers, children, I imagine that you've had a lot of conversations with parents who have doubts and concerns, probably at the same level as their kids. And what have those conversations been like?
Actually, I've been lucky. I've been able to talk to very liberal, very progressive parents, to very conservative religious parents. And each time, it's just patience. So the liberal, progressive parents, sometimes they really want to let you handle that part of bringing up their kids because they just can't even bring it up.
They say, like, you seem to be knowing what you do. Could you do this on my part? Right.
I've had parents say to me, June, I cannot even talk to my kid about her period. Like, you please just do this.
Right.
And, you know, I don't want to brand that parent irresponsible because I think not everybody is suited to having all types of conversations. So at least they're reaching out. Many parents who are not having these conversations are not reaching out either. It's just being swept under the rug, okay? The parents that are really conservative, are you teaching the Christian way? Are you Christian? They look at me, I'm Chinese, right? And they think, are you Christian? You must be Christian, right? And then I have to slowly break down that boundary by talking about what I do teach. And I ask them, maybe I can tell you what I teach. Would you like to know? And then they're like, oh, okay, fine, engage me. Then you tell them, oh, well, actually, this stuff. And you know, kids are doing this stuff. And I know this from my experience talking to children. And then I tell the parents, and they're like, oh my God, yes, my kid does that all the time. How do you deal with that? It's hard. You got to sell to the kids, sell to the parents.
And for not Christian parents, but maybe Malay Muslim parents, is there a similar...
Malay Muslim parents are actually a lot cooler than Christian parents.
And what are they wanting to know about what you're teaching?
I'll tell you something. 60 kids, super kampong place up north, Malay parents turn up to pick up their kids in like kapchais and stuff. All of them. Terima kasih.
But do they know what you're teaching?
I don't think they want to know.
Oh, but they acknowledge that they also don't want to handle it, but they're happy with what you're going to be teaching.
From what I see.
Interesting.
It's like I find it so difficult to talk about this thing, but I'm so glad someone is doing it for me. So I want to thank you for your help. Even urban areas, when I do urban workshops, right? When it's Malay parents, they're so cool about it. If they're sending their kid to this workshop, they never have any issues with the content. I've never had a Malay Muslim parent ask me about content. I mean, in the first place, I'm very open. I'm serious.
No way.
I'm serious.
Wait, hang on. So, I mean, I'm trying to think about an exchange that you may have had with a Malay Muslim parent saying, June, do you really believe that by teaching X, Y, and Z that this will protect my child? Like, has no Malay Muslim parent questioned at least some part of what you're teaching?
I promise you, right? And I'm very public about my work.
Yeah.
No one.
That's interesting.
This is the unfounded fear. It's the fear of sex ed where there's nothing to fear. It's the fear that parents will have a big backlash over you teaching comprehensive sex ed when you don't even know if they'll complain. And they don't. I have never had parents come up to me and say, what are you teaching my kid?
In addressing the existing fear of understanding and being taught about sex, it's apparent from our conversation now that it's happening with the kids and the parents themselves. I mean, it's based on, I guess, legacy issues. That's it?
There was a big jump, you see, between parents of teenagers today and when they were teenagers themselves. The internet era happened really fast. So they're really, if you have a teenager today, you're really ill-equipped to deal with this. Yeah, I think arguably you're ill-equipped at any age, lah. But now it's worse than ever because parents feel kind of helpless because this information is coming at their children at such a rapid rate. They can't control it anymore. So I get a lot of kids who are like really sheltered still. Like, oh, you're not allowed to do this, you're not allowed to do that. And actually by doing that, you're actually harming the kid more. It is definitely a generational problem. But more than that, it's a societal problem. We live in a country where every mention of sex is censored, like I mentioned earlier. Every mention of sex is censored, even mention of intimacy within, like, even acceptable realms, such as, for example, married loving parents, right? They censor that, yeah? So how are kids ever supposed to learn about anything? How do you start a discussion on the subject when they don't see anything? In sex ed, we have what are called teachable moments. If you see something or like a dirty scene on TV and you say, oh, what are they doing there? Let's talk about that. But there are no teachable moments. And there are fewer and fewer of those, the more of them we censor.
This topic about sex ed occurs within the context of every time there's a baby dumping case. We saw the Richard Huckle issue emerge about the concern of who is approaching our kids. And then we had Noor Fitri Azmir Nordin in the UK, who was arrested and caught with an obscene amount of extreme pornographic material.
Child pornography.
Yeah. In both those cases, there seemed to be an alignment about putting down everything associated with Richard Huckle in his particular scenario. But yet there was some hesitation on the Noor Fitri example. For me, it seems so clear that these are both part of the same boat, that there's a root cause to this. Why do you think in those particular cases that it kind of differed?
I think in the Noor Fitri case, there's a huge debate raging on this matter, actually. In the Noor Fitri case, the authorities that are defending him are saying he's our scholar, we can't just leave him there, which is why we're helping him with his deportation and all that, right? But there's no sort of... What crime did he commit? He has child pornography. And I think a lot of people see that as, yeah, he had porn, but it's not like he did anything to the kids. But Richard Huckle, he was like actively seeking kids and actively doing things to them. But what people, I think, have failed to realize is that both the Richard Huckle case and the Noor Fitri case, both of them involve the sexual exploitation of minors in one way or another, right? And I don't think people have put enough thought into the fact that maybe some of our kids were in some of those videos, you know? So I think that's why people are quick to go like, that's a lesser crime. I want to say that he's one of ours is one of the reasons. He's one of us. So he couldn't possibly be as bad as the big, bad white guy, the foreigner who came to our shores and abused our children. But I agree with you that it's the same. It's on the same level. And like I explained earlier, it involves the sexual exploitation of minors, both cases. And I think people don't appreciate that. They want to see an active move to sexually exploit minors. Like, you had sex with a minor. That's sexual abuse. But child pornography, for some reason, people don't see it as a big deal. Like, people here seem to think that, oh, it's a passive form of a problem. So it's not so bad.
When in fact, it's not.
It's really not. Like, where do you think the footage comes from? You know, so it's like there's no connection. Like I said earlier, that could be your kid on video. You don't even know that, you know.
How do you think, I mean, and you know, because we can't wait for another Richard Huckle. We can't wait for the next Noor Fitri to happen. I mean, what can be done to, I guess, accelerate and create a real movement rather than being reactive and responsive to these kinds of issues?
Okay. Well, I've given the matter a lot of thought. And I think that now that the public is finally starting to take notice of child sexual abuse in our society, it's been going on for a really long time. We need to ask ourselves this question, right? Why are our children so vulnerable to sexual predators online and in real time, on the streets? And then we need to ask ourselves, do our children have enough information and guidance to keep themselves safe? And if not, why not? And that, to me, effectively puts an end to whether abstinence-based education, sex education is better or comprehensive sex education is better. There's no question that kids need comprehensive sex education so that they can learn about how to stay safe, how to choose the right kind of company, how to walk away when something is unsafe, to keep them safe. And to me personally, within comprehensive sex education, the most important lesson that needs to be taught is sexual pleasure. And I know it rings a lot of alarm bells when I say that, but here's the thing. Kids don't know what is bad. They don't know what's good. You censor everything. They don't have a barometer on what's good and what's bad. We do have these trainings on safe touches and unsafe touches, but it's not enough. It needs to go further. And the reason I say sexual pleasure is so important is because the conversation on sexual pleasure is inherently linked to the conversation on consent.
Right.
Yeah. If you go to a 5-year-old and you say, did you consent to that? You won't understand. If you say, how did you feel about that? How did that make you feel?
It's easier for the kid to express that sentiment.
Yeah. And like some of the classes I do is just focused on giving kids the vocabulary to express their feelings. And I think that our culture also is such that don't ask, don't tell, kids should be seen and not heard. There's still a lot of that going on. So kids don't feel like they can tell their parents that they've experienced something awful because the parents will just say, don't be ridiculous. But if we give our kids the vocabulary to be more articulate in what they're feeling, what they're experiencing, and we as adults, responsible adults, are more receptive to what they're saying, I think we can spot these incidences of abuses, if they're happening, much faster than we are right now. If we're really serious about getting to the bottom of this.
Because a huge problem is, and you're encountering it in a lot of your meetings with parents and kids, is this communication thing, right? And you spoke about giving this vocabulary. Is it because they might not actually know what they're feeling, and B, they might not actually know how to describe what they're feeling?
Exactly.
So what's part of this vocabulary?
It starts with the correct names for genitalia.
And why is that important?
Because kids are going like, he touched me there. Where? Why is it wrong for him to touch you there? She touched me there. She put that there. And you get names like hoo-hoo and ha-ha, and kids don't know the significance of those parts, the genitalia, why those should be kept clean, sacred, protected, etc. But over and above that, they don't know how to say things like, it hurts because something strange was inserted into it. It hurts because at night my dad does this to me. 5-year-old kid saying, dad is not a bad guy, just at night he puts it in me. And mother living in denial, not knowing how to deal with it, being in an economically trying situation, unable to get out of this situation. So I think it's really beyond empowering them with knowledge on sex education, it's also empowering them with the vocabulary and the communication skills to ask for help when they need it, to recognize risky situations. And how do you recognize that a situation is not ideal? Like I mentioned earlier, we censor all talk about sex. So even when it's consensual, loving sex, we censor that.
Because there's no reference point now, right?
We don't have
any way of communicating that.
My personal problem with this is that sex is a natural part of almost everyone's development. Yeah, everyone is here because someone had sex. Yeah.
Do you start with that? I feel like that's a good intro.
It's my favorite line.
To your sessions.
Everyone is here because someone had sex.
We're here because of the sex thing.
But sex is still seen as such a deviant behavior, like bad behavior. Tell kids, hey, that's bad, don't do it. I'll tell you how far it extends. There's no talk about sexual pleasure. There's no discussion on how what an orgasm is and why it should feel good for the man and the woman. And no talk about consent. So nobody has any idea what is good or bad. And this conversation about pleasure, how does it feel for you? That you can ask a 5-year-old, and you should ask a 30-year-old. How does it feel for you? Does that feel okay? Do you want to stop? These kind of things. Simple, simple sentences.
Very,
like
very
that.
Basic sentiments that you're trying to extract, right?
That doing that is seeking affirmative consent. We live in a culture of in rape culture, right? Massive rape culture going on in our society. And men feel entitled and women feel weak. This is the only way we're going to stop that. If we teach young people that consent matters. Yeah, we're going to stop the abuse by letting young people know that they can stand up against that or they can leave. That they don't have to be subjected to abuse.
Have you been in these rooms when the abstinence-based stuff is being taught to the kids?
I've had people interject with abstinence, pro-abstinence stances during my workshops. They will say stuff. And I remember this one incident very clearly. I was talking about condoms and kids were looking at the condoms. We'd given out condoms and we're like, this is what it feels like. We're desensitizing them towards the condom. Oh, it's so sticky. Yeah, that's lubricant, which is used to guide the penis into the vagina. And one of the facilitators, which came from the sponsor company, she was very religious and she said, yeah, but you just look at it. You don't need it when you're married. And I said, and then she said, isn't that right, Miss June?
What was your response?
I said, absolutely not. You know, if we're talking about transmission of HIV, for example, it's highest amongst housewives. So I would be putting that on even if I am married. And a kid puts up her hand. And you know what she says? She goes like, yeah, but apart from the HIV, if let's say I already have 5 kids and I can't afford to have a 6th one, maybe I should use this? Kids have brains, you know. You can't lie to them for too long. So like,
so that kid answered the question
yeah. No one said anything after that. So I've had people interject with nonsense, and kids just put them in their places.
That was my conversation with sex educator June Lau. Check out her video series Pop It Pop It on YouTube. This episode was produced by Pamela Fong. If you missed any part of this interview, or if you wish to share this conversation about sex education, all you need to do is download the BFM 89.9 app on the Apple App Store or on Google Play. And then just download the podcast. I'm Ezra Zayed for the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.